Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Happy New Year to you. And today we're going to take you back in time to something that was going on this time of year, 66 years ago, the Battle of the Bulge. We're going to talk to someone who was there among his many experiences in the military. He's a veteran of both World War II and the Korean War. It's Don Freeze. He'll turn 86 later this month. Born in Fresno, lives in Fresno now. And Don, let's go back to before World War II, 1941. I like to start by asking each veteran what he remembers about that day that everyone seems to have some memory of, December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Yep. I was out at Sunnyside Golf Course hauling clubs for a doctor when the news came over the radio, and I guess we didn't hear about it until we finished the ninth hole.
Was that something that hit you as a big deal at the time, or was like, oh, that's interesting, okay, and then go play another nine holes, or at least carry the bags another nine holes?
Well, I turned around and carried the bags another nine holes, but I also thought that the Japanese were a little crazy and they'd be over in about 6 months, because I didn't know much about what was going on.
When did it hit you that this thing that was going on in the world was probably going to have an impact on your life, too?
Well, let's see. When I graduated from Edison, which was in 42, and I went job hunting and ended up in Santa Clara Valley and worked as a heavy operator, I guess you'd say, for diversified farming. We worked in prune orchards, apple orchards, pear orchards, and had quite a bit of land across from Moffett Field where we had tomatoes and different things.
So I'm sure if you saw those blimps at Moffett Field, you probably said, hey, I want to be one of those lighter-than-air guys. But you didn't end up in the Navy. You ended up in the Army. Was that by your choice, or did Uncle Sam get a hold of you?
Well, I didn't have to go because I was an essential farmer, I guess you'd say. But I looked around one day and saw I was the only young guy I met anywhere around the area, and finally decided that everything was caught up, and I just told the boss I wanted to go ahead and let him draft me, and it only took 2 days, and I was drafted.
Boy, they don't mess around when someone's on the table. I guess they snatch them up pretty quick. So you got drafted by the Army. You end up in the 1st Infantry Division. But I'm sure there was probably a welcome to the Army moment for you. Usually I talk to guys who worked in the farming industry, and they felt like being on a farm kind of prepared them for basic training and all that. You were already kind of toughened up. Was that your experience, or did the Army have some more toughening up to do for you?
I wasn't as tough as a lot of people think I might be, but I went into the Army, and of course they asked me when I got to Fort Ord what I'd like to do in the Army. I told them, you know, I could drive truck and tractor and things like that, and they said, well, we'll give you a wheelbarrow, and that's about as far as it went. So I was just plain infantry after 17 weeks at Camp Roberts.
So here you are. I mean, you're a pretty young man. You got your whole life in front of you. How did you feel about heading overseas and the combat that you knew you were going to see as an infantryman?
Well, in one way, it was kind of exciting to... I had never gotten out of California. So moving across country and then across the ocean and into a land that I had never seen before, it was sort of breathtaking, except for the fact that when we landed, we had to trounce through mud something like 6 or 8 inches deep every place you went. It was mud, and moved into a replacement camp And so about 3 days later, ended up in the 1st Infantry Division.
And whenever I talk to someone who was a replacement, it always strikes me that just that label, being a replacement, has to kind of mess with your head a little bit. If they need replacements, what happened to the guys who were there before, right?
Right. And when I got to where my assignment was in the 18th Infantry, the company that I was going into only had about 112 men at the time, and when 210 come, you know, as a company of infantry. So they had lost a whole bunch of men about 2 days before that, attacking up a hill. My first duty, or assignment, I guess, was they said, well, come on, we got to haul some of the dead bodies away. And my first job was to get a second lieutenant who's caught in a tree when he fell off the side of the hill, shot in the head. His foot got caught in the fork of the tree. And my job was to get his foot out of there and drop him down so we could tarp him and the medics would take him from there, I guess.
So if this war thing wasn't real to you yet, I guess at that moment it was.
It was very real. Oh, I had one good thing. I could choose whether to be a rifleman or a mortarman, and of course I took the mortar, which was very odd. It's a small, the 60 millimeter is quite small, but you carry a lot of, you have to have a lot of weights to carry around, and all the little guys went into the mortars. I don't know why. The big ones carried rifles.
And you say, obviously, you chose the mortar. Some people may not understand how simple that choice is, but it's a matter of how close to the front line you are, right?
Well, of course, we were always about, most of the time, at least 400 yards behind the front lines, which made it a little bit easier. We could move around and all through Germany, went from one cellar to another. We didn't always have to dig our holes, except for the mortar. And we could sleep in the cellars and different things like that occasionally. And then we got into the woods and stuff, and then we had to start digging holes.
And then you got to the woods where the ground was so hard you couldn't dig a hole. And we're going to talk about Don's experience at the Battle of the Bulge. As far as these mortars, 60 millimeter mortar, how did those work? And was it something that was easy to operate for you? Could you do it yourself? Did you need another man with you? Give us a taste of what that was like.
Well, a mortar squad consisted of six people: the squad leader, the gunner, assistant gunner, and some ammo bearers. And of course, ammo bearers had to carry 40 or 50 pounds of ammunition wherever they went if we had to travel and didn't have vehicles. And the mortar itself was carried normally by the assistant gunner. The gunner carried the sights and maybe the base plate. And the rest, of course, we also carried ammunition if it was real necessary. And normally, the gunner, an assistant gunner, carried the HE rounds and...
That's high explosive for people that don't get it, right? And you had different, the reason you had HEs was because you had other kinds of rounds too.
Flares, you know, that we could fire up to light up the front. And actually, basically what we did, we each, there was three mortars in a company. So they were, if a platoon of infantry had to separate from the company or something, they normally took at least one mortar with them, depending on the situation. Otherwise, we tried to keep all three together.
Now, on a given day, if you're in a combat zone, do you, when you get up in the morning, do you have an idea of where you're going to go and what you're going to be up against, or are you flying by the seat of your pants from dawn to dusk?
Well, I don't know about the seat of the pants, but we did a lot of walking, and we never knew where we were going until I got up to, as squad leader. And then, of course, I got to some of the meetings, and they'd tell us what was going on. But other than that, it was just a lot of hard labor and getting your gun dug in and getting sighted on prospective targets in the event of an attack or something of that sort.
Was that something you could lock in on pretty quickly? I would assume you'd have to in the heat of battle. You'd have to be able to aim and fire in relative quickness.
Well, that was the purpose. If you weren't attacking, you could set up and then pick out, like I said, prospective targets where the enemy might appear, or where in the event we attacked, where we would want to drop rounds in front of our troops. And that's about it, I guess.
All right, well, we're going to take our first commercial break, but when we come back and throughout the rest of the show, we'll find out why Don, on the wall of his Fresno home, has a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star hanging there, among other medals. We'll get those stories from 85-year-old for now. He's got another month of being 85. Don Freeze of Fresno, California. We'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll continue now with World War II veteran and Korean War veteran, Battle of the Bulge survivor Don Freeze of Fresno, California. He gave us a little explanation of what it meant to be in a mortar squad, as he was, as part of the 1st Infantry Division in World War II. Now, you got to the European continent in the fall of 1944. By December 16th of 1944, there was a little something starting that we now know as the Battle of the Bulge. Walk us through the build-up to that, how you experienced and how your outfit first entered that world-famous battle.
Well, we had pulled back to Belgium to get new reinforcements and get them trained to understand a little bit about what was going to happen to them in the front lines. And I don't know, first notice we got, we had been there about a week or so when we heard about the Battle of the Bulge, and the Germans, you could see them flying over and in some cases dropping paratroopers not far from us. So we actually just started walking toward where the Germans were at, and it just got pretty intensive.
And of course the Ardennes forest, heavily forested area and well fortified, and the weather is infamous in this time of world history, the worst winter they had ever seen. And I'm sure growing up in Fresno probably hadn't prepared you for the cold conditions you faced there.
To begin with, it was quite rainy and muddy and things that we weren't used to here in Fresno. But and then the cold weather settled in, and that, of course, got things even worse because it got cold enough, so if you tried to dig a hole, unless you had dynamite or something to blast with or TNT, it was just almost impossible to dig holes, but until you got through at least a foot and a half or so of the ground. And like I said, we tried to always dig in the 60-millimeter mortars. Prior to our foxholes or in the woods, we tried to get sleeping holes and stuff so you could put a top on. We put logs over the top to keep from getting clobbered when the artillery came in. And then, of course, it got real cold, and when the Battle of the Bulge started, it was real cold weather, and for a while, we wanted to be a mortar squad, but for a long time, we were looking for German soldiers in the woods, and everybody became an infantryman, at least for about a week, until we got settled and knew what was going on.
So you had to rely on a rifle for self-defense and self-preservation with, you know, enemy soldiers wandering through the woods, and I guess you had developed a pretty sharp shooting eye. I've seen some of your sharpshooting medals on the wall there too. Did you feel pretty comfortable and confident with that rifle on your shoulder?
Oh, I was confident about the rifle. I wasn't confident about what was going to happen, because we couldn't use the mortars very well. We were in a heavy woods where they planted trees in Germany. Every year they plant trees to grow up and use for fence posts and then lumber. So all we could think about was getting undercover and going forward when they said forward.
I can't imagine it was very easy to sleep at night for multiple reasons. First, you're probably shivering to death, and second, you don't know what's out there. Did you find any way to kind of help you cope with the ever-present danger of an enemy and Mother Nature with the fierce weather?
Oh, you get used to know what's going on, and about half the men would stay up at night no matter where we were stationed, and the other half would try to sleep. And believe it or not, you can sleep under very, very bad conditions. You can sleep real well after a while.
How was your relationship with the other guys in your squad? I've talked to some guys who would say they saw so many casualties day in, day out, that they were hesitant to form too close of a bond with someone else because they were afraid of losing them. What was your experience? Did you get to know those guys real well? Did you have that real close, trustful relationship, or were you kind of at arm's length?
One or two became quite, you might say, foxhole buddies. One especially in another squad became a lifelong friend. In fact, he just died about 6 years ago, but it was after crossing the Rhine River. He got hurt real bad and was in the hospital actually for about 2 years before he could even come out again and get around. But then we got to know each other again after, when I come home on furlough or shortly after I retired, we became real good friends again. He became a rice farmer up around Oroville. It was just a lifetime friendship with him. Now, there's two or three others I got to know real well and got to liking, but most of them got themselves killed.
Well, and when you see that happen, and you described how the very first thing you had to do in Europe in World War II was pull a dead officer out of a tree, when you see the guys that you know go down, you know that they're not coming back, doesn't it make you wonder, am I next? When's my number going to get called? When is my time going to be up? Is that something that you couldn't avoid thinking about?
Well, you couldn't avoid thinking about it because you look at some of the men that had been with the outfit, with the company for years, and maybe you only got wounded slightly once or twice, and then all of a sudden he catches it, an artillery round or machine gun or something, and he's dead. So you wonder, when is my turn?
Well, there are some times I'm sure you thought it almost was your turn. And you mentioned a moment ago putting logs on top of a foxhole just in case artillery came in when you were in there. How often did it happen that artillery landed very close to you, that fire was so close to you that it was killing your friends, that it was putting your life in jeopardy? Was that a very common occurrence? Was it more uncommon? How would you describe that?
Well, see, normally we were in fairly good shape being back from, like I said, a few hundred yards behind the front lines normally. And we could get dug in, and artillery, of course, was constant. They didn't fire as many rounds as we did, but you always had to worry about artillery. And tanks got to be quite a threat. When they fire those in the woods, the round is liable to hit a tree, and it just becomes shrapnel flying all over the place.
I'll ask you about the Purple Heart now, because you're talking about artillery fire and hitting trees, becoming shrapnel, and trying to duck for cover. Now you have the Purple Heart, and that tells me that you were eventually hit. What were the circumstances of that, and what can you tell us?
Well, we were in the attack situation and going again through the woods. Normally the riflemen take care of anything out in front, but in this case we were trying to clear out of small woods that the tanks Patton and them had gone through, and they left little pockets that we tried to clean out as infantrymen. And on one of the thing, one of the situations developed where they had bypassed a machine gun. I guess it had a lot of ammunition and were quite accurate. And they opened fire on our mortar section as we were going through. And, of course, first thing you do is hit the ground if you can. And I hit the ground and looked for anything that was low, and I ended up in a slit trench, straddle trench, or whatever you want to call it. But even though it was real messy, it did save my life because only part of my rear end was showing and I got nicked on it. And then shortly thereafter, when shrapnel came in, I got wounded on the wrist and nothing serious.
Now, I want to give our listeners the full picture of this here. When you talk about a slit trench, somebody might change the second letter in slit for that trench, and you know, there are a lot of different pictures we could paint of that, but maybe understanding what those trenches are normally used for would give our listeners an idea what you're dealing with.
It's a toilet. And it was full.
So you were up to your eyeballs and stuff that didn't smell too good, and it probably stayed that way for a while?
Right. I was in there for 2-3 minutes before I could get out, before they got the machine gunner.
Did you need immediate medical attention, or would no one want to come very near you at that point?
Oh, at that time, there was no medical attention needed. I mean, our first aid man just bandaged me up, and we had no problem. It was shortly after that, though, that I got a slight case of frostbite, so they sent me back to the hospital to recover from that or be treated for that. And when I got there, they found out I had yellow jaundice, is what we used to call it. Now they call it hepatitis, but the yellow eyes and all that stuff. So I was about 2 weeks in the hospital in France. And that was wonderful. Laying on just a little canvas cot was heaven. But they got it cured and everything, and told me about one day. They told me I was going into the replacement center and be sent back up to the front. And, of course, I wanted my outfit, so I went AWOL and headed for the front and had no trouble at all. Everybody, even though they knew I was AWOL, I was going in the right direction, so I finally got back to my outfit and resumed the battle.
Now, you say that all so matter-of-factly, but I'm thinking of myself in your shoes, and your whole life as a member of the military is based on following orders and not disobeying them. What made you decide that in this case you weren't going to listen to them and you're going to do your own thing?
Just the fact that I wanted to be back among people I knew, well, that I soldiered with, and I was sure they'd welcome me back, so I went that way.
And clearly you made it.
Yes. Yep. They were, in fact, they were in a rest position where nothing was going on when I finally got back there. And everything continued on as it was.
Well, when you look back at the incident that earned you the Purple Heart, you're wounded on your rear, on your hand. You dealt with the contents of the slit trench, ended up with the jaundice, and were in the hospital. The amount of time that took you out of combat, do you ever look back and say, oh, that may have saved my life? I wasn't there during that time period. There are probably other guys in your outfit that were getting killed during that time. Is that fair to say?
It wasn't as bad as I thought it might be, because they had been in a rest position, you might say, for about a week, getting in replacements and things like that. And there actually weren't too many soldiers that I knew real well that had gotten hurt during the period I was gone, which made me happy.
Don Freeze is our guest today, 85 years old, of Fresno, California, served with the 1st Infantry Division in Europe in World War II. We heard him describe the incident that earned him the Purple Heart. He also has a Bronze Star. We'll ask him about that. And beyond those two medals, there's something much more valuable to him that he was able to bring back to the United States after World War II. We'll find out what that is when Hometown Heroes continues next here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing this time of year on the Battle of the Bulge. And before we get back to the story of Don Fries, let's get a little perspective on that battle, which was raging on around the frozen ground of Belgium, Luxembourg, and Germany 66 years ago, from December 16, 1944, to January 25, 1945. It involved more than 1 million soldiers on both sides. More than 19,000 Americans gave their lives in that battle. Another 70,000 were either wounded, captured, or left missing in action. It was the largest and bloodiest battle of World War II for American forces. And if you have a family member who participated in the Battle of the Bulge, there is an active chapter of the Battle of the Bulge Survivors Association in Fresno. If you'd like more information on that group, give Earl the Pearl Watson a call at 559-298-0764. That's 298-0764 for Earl the Pearl. I'll also post that info on our website, kmjnow.com, along with some photos of today's guest, Don Fries, which you'll also find on Facebook if you look up Hometown Heroes there. So the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or kmjnow.com. One thing that's fun to do on this program from time to time to complement the firsthand accounts of our veterans is to dig up audio from the past. And 66 years ago, at the start of 1945, President Franklin D. Roosevelt informed the country about Allied progress at the Battle of the Bulge in his radio address. Here's FDR from January 1945.
We have seen a year marked on the whole by substantial progress toward victory, even though the year ended with a setback for our arms when the Germans launched a ferocious counterattack into Luxembourg and Belgium with the obvious objectives of cutting our line in the center. Our men have fought with indescribable and unforgettable gallantry under most difficult conditions. The high tide of this German attack was reached 2 days after Christmas. Since then, we have reassumed the offensive. We have rescued the isolated garrison at Bastogne and forced a German withdrawal along most of the line of the salient. The speed with which we have recovered from this savage attack was possible primarily because we have one supreme commander in complete control of all the Allied armies in France. General Eisenhower has faced this period of trial with admirable calm and resolution and with steadily increasing success. He has my complete confidence.
And it turned out for good reason. That was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt during the Battle of the Bulge 66 years ago. So now let's continue with one of those men who, as you heard FDR put it, fought with indescribable and unforgettable gallantry. Battle of the Bulge survivor Don Fries, a veteran of World War II and Korea. He lives in Fresno, California. And we talked about the Purple Heart, and he's able to laugh about it now, where he ended up, where he was wounded. He's thankful that he's here to talk about it. There's another medal that hangs near that Purple Heart, the combat infantry badge on his wall. It's the Bronze Star. And Don, one thing I've realized over the years in interviewing so many veterans is a lot of time it's hard to get them to talk about their decorations. I find some guys who won't even tell me about the prestigious medals they have until after I'm done interviewing them. But I've seen the Bronze Star. I know it's there. And I know you don't like to draw attention to yourself, but if you can, share with me the events that led to you being awarded that Bronze Star and how you experienced it.
Well, it occurred during one of our attack phases. We're moving up through the woods, and all of a sudden we got clobbered by tanks. Or tank fire, and it was pretty devastating because we were caught off guard, and quite a few people went down, and there was one small group that was starting to be being surrounded by the German infantry that was counterattacking. And there was no way to use the mortars at that time, and so I helped by going forward and helping to lay down a little bit of rifle fire and trying to relieve the men that were up there, and we finally got the Germans to retreat, and they thought it was, actually it was the only thing I could do, but they thought it was pretty good, so they gave me a medal.
Well, and it sounds like, as I'm trying to picture this in my head, listening to you describe it, so the American soldiers were surrounded by the Germans, so they were in jeopardy. They're in jeopardy of being killed or captured if no one did anything.
I guess that's the way you'd put it. We just, well, all we did was help move the Germans back so it would relieve our infantry people that were being surrounded, and we got them out. That's about it.
So in your mind, it was no big deal. You did what you were there to do, but somebody thought it was special, and I've heard a lot of different stories about medals like that, too. Sometimes you've got a general around to pin it on you. Sometimes it gets mailed home. You don't even know you got it. Other times, guys wait 65 years to get it. Did you have any kind of memorable receiving of that medal, or was that a no-big-deal kind of situation for you, too?
No, it was a no-big-deal. I don't even remember how it was presented to me.
So you're there with the 1st Infantry Division throughout the entire Battle of the Bulge and still there in Europe until the end of the war. Were there any other close calls you experienced that kind of really gave you pause or made you go to sleep that night, thanking God that you were still around?
Well, I was strafed 3 times during that period of the war, twice by our planes and once by the Germans, and we can sure strafe better than the Germans could. But they came pretty close, but they missed.
And I know it doesn't matter who's shooting at you. If the bullets are flying, you're taking cover, but I bet that made you pretty mad when your own planes are shooting at you and there's nothing you can do about it.
No, by then I understood. I mean, it was easy for them to mistake what they were firing at simply because we were intermingling with Germans, and I understood it. I mean, it still scared the heck out of me, but I understood it. And like I say, boy, our planes could strafe good compared to the Germans.
So you were a lot more fearful when they were shooting at you, I suppose. May 8th, 1945 rolls around. The war in Europe officially comes to an end. Was that a big deal for you and the guys you were with? Was there some celebration of that, or was that muted?
Oh, we celebrated. I mean, we just yelled and hollered and a few other odds and ends. And then a day or two later, we met the Russians. They were coming in. And, I don't know. Everybody was real happy, but the infantry, or the 1st Division at least, within 2 days we were training again, trying to keep people in shape and understand what's going on. By then I was a platoon sergeant and had to learn a lot of things, like, that I didn't know how to do before, such as drilling troops and things of that sort. And I had to do a lot of reading and a lot of yelling and a lot of work.
Were you convinced that the war was over? Because, I mean, this whole time, that no one ever told you it starts now and it ends then. I mean, it's an indefinite thing for you the entire time. Was there part of you that said this may not be over yet and you were still somewhat on guard?
No. The only thing we could think of was, I hope they leave us here for a while instead of sending us to Japan, or to the Pacific, I should say. But that's about all.
Were you in a hurry to get home? Were you checking how many points you'd earned and whether you had enough to get home?
Yep, there was a big thing going on there for a while. Of course, I wanted to get home real bad and had very few points because I'd only been over there for a few months, whereas some of them had been there for years. And, of course, only one Purple Heart didn't count for too many votes and or points. So, yes, and then, like I say, we went into training, and eventually the outfit was moved to the border, and we took up patrolling and the border, or guarding the border, I should say, and things were going fairly good, and then I met this German Fraulein, and she was a cute little thing, and all of a sudden, I didn't care too much about whether I got the points to go home or not. So, since we couldn't get married right away or anything like that, we knew we'd have to wait. I re-enlisted and for another 3 years, and then eventually went home to take a 90-day furlough. They had told me when I re-enlisted, I could have 90-day furlough, and I figured that was some kind of a reward. I didn't know I had to earn it, so I owed the Army quite a few days when I finally came off my furlough. But then they decided they were going to send me over to the Pacific, and that didn't make me too happy, and I talked real hard and finally won reassignment to Germany.
Which proved to be very convenient and very influential in the rest of your life, as you could spend more time with that Fraulein you were talking about. I want to ask you more about that when we come back. The rest of Don Free's story and that most precious prize he brought home from Europe after World War II, Hometown Heroes, will come down the home stretch after this on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you're from the Fresno area, you may be familiar with the name Bobby Freeze. Perhaps he bested you on the golf course once or twice, or you know he's in the Fresno Athletic Hall of Fame as a legendary track and cross-country coach in the high school and junior college ranks, even coaching in the U.S. Olympic Development Program for years. Well, this afternoon, you've been listening to one of the older brothers of Bobby Freeze. This is Don Freeze, who will turn 86 at the end of this month. You've heard Don describe how he earned the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart, but he eventually came home from World War II with something much more valuable than a medal. And I want to explore more of that now as we get into the final portion of the program today. Don, you mentioned meeting a young Fraulein.
Tell me about that, because I have to imagine, here you are, you've spent the last several months fighting the Germans, and I'm sure you could differentiate between Hitler and the Third Reich and just the German people, but I'm sure that wasn't the first thing you thought of going over there. Hey, I'm going to meet somebody that's from the enemy side and strike up a relationship with her. How did that process in your mind, and maybe tell me a little bit more about that meeting and why she made such a strong impression on you?
Well, the first time I didn't even notice her. We had a company dance, and we were setting up in a small town where she was at, and actually at that dance I noticed a blonde and sort of danced with her all night, and then about 3 days later is when my wife and I met. Well, the girl and I met, and she was somebody that loved to dance, so she tried to, we had to have passes and stuff when we opened up what we call the Schützenhaus, but it looks like a big gymnasium, and that's where we had, the company would gather at night, and but she was too young to get one of those passes. I didn't know it, but she was only 15 years old. She hadn't told me anything about her age until then. But then I had to, of course, I got to the company commander, and I finally talked him into letting her in on special pass if I thought that she should, you know, be allowed into the club. So from then on, boy, did she teach me to dance. And of course, I fell in love. Well, I fell in love the first time I saw her, I guess, but it got stronger and stronger, so we started applying for papers and things like that, and it was a big, long struggle, but after I'd gone back to the States and then came back, it took us, another couple of years before we could get all the papers together. She didn't even have a birth certificate because the town she lived in had been destroyed. And finally settled for the fact that on the back of her folks' marriage license, they had shown when she was born and so on and so forth. They settled for that. And then one Thursday in 1948, we got word that we could get married on Saturday and that we would leave Germany on Monday. So actually, they'd been preparing for it for a long time, so we had a fairly decent time getting married. But then I had to go about 250 miles in a Jeep at night all the way back to the town where her records were and get her exit permit and so on and so forth, and come back and made it just in time to get on a train, and we headed for Munich where we were going to catch an airplane. But that was a year that the whole of Europe was fogged in. I mean heavy fog. And we stayed in Munich for about almost a week. Never could get us, so they decided they're going to ship us home by boat. And we went, grabbed a train, headed for Bremerhaven, and got there just in time to wave goodbye to the boat. It was already leaving. So we had to get back to Munich, and 2 days later, we got to catch an airplane. I mean, they got us on an airplane and got us into New York. But it was a hectic time.
Sounds like it was all worth it, though.
It was worth it. Because I love her just as much now as I did then, and probably will for as long as we both live.
Well, and she said you said that she's taught you how to dance, and I guess you guys have been dancing one way or another ever since, huh?
Right. Not too much lately, but because she's having problems. But anyway, after we got to New York, the Army promised me an assignment to the West Coast, and we didn't have too much money even at the time, but we took a train for California, came back to Fresno, and got here about New Year's Eve, just in time to go dancing. And then after about 3, 4, 5 days of merriment, we got orders, and my orders were Fort Devens, Massachusetts. So I had to work my way back to Fort Devens, left my wife in Fresno, and it was a few months, and 3 or 4 months I finally got to send for her, and we settled at Fort Devens for a while. And then, like I said, I think one time before I told you, my wife one day says, "We're not making enough money." All I had was one little old used car and one child. And so finally, she convinced me, and I applied for OCS and went to OCS. I guess I was 29 years old already. But I got through that real well, and then finally had a short tour and at Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, and where my second son was born. And from there, then I got orders for Korea, and we headed back to Fresno. At that time, we had a very small two-door sedan with two children and a dog and lots of luggage. But we made it.
Clearly, and I know you would finish up your military career as a major after your time in Korea and all. And I don't know if there's anything that you want to add about Korea, because it's often referred to as the forgotten war. Certainly doesn't get as much attention as World War II or Vietnam, for that matter. Do you look back with some pride at the significance of what guys did over there, even if it's not always appreciated here?
I don't know. I got there after the war ended, of course. So all we had was little things to do and roads to build. I became an engineer, even if I was an infantryman. But I had learned how to build roads, train people on how to use demolitions, build bridges, and different things like that. And I don't know exactly how hard the war was there, the fighting, but I could appreciate how hard they must have had to fight, because it's not the best territory in the world to fight in. You either got hills to climb or paddies to cross, and going through a rice paddy is not easy, as I found out.
Let me ask you this, Don, as we wrap up this time on the program, and if there's anything else you want to add, feel free. But when you look back at everything that you went through in the Army, and every veteran seems to have great memories and some things he'd probably rather forget about time in the service, and especially in wartime, you ever look back and say, well, I really can't complain, because if I hadn't been in the Army, if I hadn't have been in World War II, I never would have met my wife. My kids and grandkids never would have been born, and who knows what life would have been. Is that something you've given some thought to?
Oh, yes. And after Korea, of course, I left Korea because my son drowned here in Bass Lake, and came back, and I was assigned to the Presidio of San Francisco as a headquarters commandant, and served there almost 6 years, in which time I got my college education and a few other things by going to school at night. It was a good 6 years, one that I appreciated very much. And for once, the Army did exactly what I thought they should do, was let me get educated as soon as I got my degree. Of course, I had orders. They wanted to know if I wanted to serve in Chicago or that area as an ROTC instructor. And I said, well, I'd much rather go to Europe or back to Germany if possible. And believe it or not, they let me do it. I had to go to Fort Benning and train and stuff like that. Actually, I had orders to begin with for Alaska. Shortly before I finished schooling at Fort Benning, they called me one day and said, your position in Alaska has been eliminated. What would you like to do? And I says, go back to Germany, of course. And so we actually got to go to Germany one more time for 3 years. Those were the easier things in life, because I had good jobs and enjoyed myself quite a bit.
You know, these days, and I'm sure you've experienced this a lot, especially people my age and younger don't know that much about World War II, probably don't understand all of what it was about. When you get a chance to talk to someone who wants to know and share how you experienced and why it was significant, what it was all about, what do you say? When you look back and you think about the guys you served with, how do you think your generation of Americans should be remembered What was it you were doing over there? Why were you doing it? And why is it important for us to remember today?
Well, we went over with a purpose. I mean, I believe our country was correct in what we did. And, of course, I think of Hitler as a demon of some kind that should have never been allowed to exist. But other than that, I'm nothing to add.
Well, I will add thank you, Don, for serving our country, and thanks for sharing some of your stories with us.
I thank you for letting me express what I think about the war. I hate war. Therefore, one of the things I forgot to tell you was when my 20 years was up, I got out even though there was a good chance of promotion coming up. But again, there was another war in Vietnam, and I really didn't want to go, so I retired, and I've never regretted it.
And I don't blame you. That's Don Freeze, our guest today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.